content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Davidson students crunch data to prevent concussions and bring in the dogs to make workers more productive. And we'll begin with Davidson students crunch data to prevent concussions. Kendall Thomas knows firsthand the steep physical price that elite athletes too often pay. A goalkeeper for the women's soccer team at Davidson College, she has endured three major knee injuries during her soccer career and watched many teammates suffer concussions, which are prevalent in the sport. Her experiences have fueled Thomas's passion for helping athletes prevent injuries. Last summer, she got a chance to do something about it, and while also delving into another of her passions, numbers. Thomas, a junior math and computer science major at Davidson, and her classmate, George Baldini, a computer science major, who is also a manager of the Davidson men's basketball team, interned with Athlete Intelligence, a Seattle-based sports technology and analytics company. Thomas and Baldini were given reams of data collected from thousands of high school and college football players across the country who wore sensors developed by Athletic Intelligence. The devices collected biometric data and information about hits to the head. The two students' mission: probing that data for coachable insights that sports programs can use to keep their athletes safer. Their opportunity came courtesy of their Davidson math professor, Tim Chartier, who has developed a national reputation for his expertise in sports analytics, working with the NBA, NASCAR, ESPN, and fantasy sports sites. In 2013, Chartier approached the Davidson men's basketball team about providing data analytics. 5 years later, Chartier and a team of 60 students are part of Cat Stats, a thriving campus group whose work includes analytics for numerous Davidson sports teams. Under Chartier's guidance, Thomas and Baldini began looking for interesting patterns in the mountains of data provided by Athlete Intelligence. They also decided to enrich the raw data they received with additional, highly relevant context, such as the size and positions of the football players in the study and other key factors that affect performance, such as elevation and air temperature. By the time they were done, the students had turned up an array of valuable insights. Quarterbacks, they found, take harder hits in practice than they do during games. While most football players tend to get hit in the front of the head, quarterbacks and special teams players are hit more frequently on the back of the head, suggesting that players at those positions should have more protection built into the backs of their helmets. Data also show that as games progress and players tire, linemen tend to drop their heads, leading to more hits on the crown of the helmet. Their innovative work attracted the attention of the PBS show Nova Next, which interviewed Chartier and Thomas. Davidson isn't the only higher education institution in North Carolina studying how to prevent, track, or treat concussions, which have become a major focal point for football and other high-impact sports, as evidence mounts that head injuries can have devastating consequences for player health over both the short and long term. Researchers at UNC Chapel Hill are engaged in a three-year, $2.6 million study funded by the NFL to study professional and amateur athletes who have suffered concussions while playing football, soccer, hockey, and other sports. They aim to evaluate the effectiveness of strategies for treating concussions. In a separate $400,000 study, UNC Chapel Hill and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point are exploring how to help athletic programs and the military develop cultures in which head injuries are reported promptly instead of being hidden, as they have been historically. Meanwhile, Duke's Clinical and Translational Science Institute is working with the NFL to develop safer helmets, and a groundbreaking study from Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center that was published in a leading medical journal documented how frequently youth football players are hit in the head during practice. The study found that 9 players had more than 2,000 combined hits to the head over 30 practices. These homegrown projects have the potential to pay off soon with better equipment and improved treatment. Over time, they can also transform the safety and performance of athletes everywhere. And this is from the Doing Better column from the News and Observer by Christopher Gergen. And he is the CEO of Forward Cities, a founding partner of HQ Community, and author of Life Entrepreneurs, Ordinary People Creating Ordinary Lives. Also, Stephen Martin is chief of staff at the Nonprofit Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro. They can be reached at authors at forwardimpact.info and followed on Twitter through at C. Gergen. And next from the News and Observer, bring in the dogs to make workers happier and more productive. Hate leaving behind your furry friend while you trudge through the hours at work? Increasingly, businesses are allowing their employees to bring their pets to the office. From large companies to locally owned stores and veterinary practices, working alongside animals, especially dogs, is becoming more common. Experts say the practice could improve workers' moods and productivity. I think for a lot of people, pets exert a major calming influence on them, said Ashley Brown, practice manager at Animal Hospital at Briar Creek in Raleigh. For our pet parents, they're not just animals, they are their babies. One of the most well-known dog-friendly companies is Amazon, which has more than 6,000 dogs joining their owners each day at its Seattle headquarters. Laura Hirschfield, Amazon's Wolfpack manager, said in a PJ Media article that the company has been dog-friendly from the beginning. Some of the canines are even profiled on Amazon's website with their name, age, favorite toy, and favorite activity. The Amazon campus includes designated relief areas, free treats, and 2 dog parks. To bring a pet to work, employees have to register the animal and talk with their manager and fellow workers to make sure everyone is comfortable with the pet. Then they have to submit a registration form, give proof of vaccination, and review Amazon's dog policies. Amazon's not the only large company that allows employees to bring their pets to work. A 2016 report from Fortune named the most pet-friendly companies in the U.S. On the list was Google, Salesforce, Genentech, Mars, Build-A-Bear Workshop, and Kempton Hotel Chain. In addition to allowing the dogs at work, many of these companies provide pet insurance and bereavement leave for the loss of a pet. While this may be the latest trend in tech companies, small businesses have been allowing pets in the workplace for years. Often it's because they have fewer employees to manage. It also depends on what their core values are and what kind of image they want to portray, Brown said. Some companies are known for taking care of employees. I think it kind of depends on that. Doug Dysing, owner of Seaboard Wine and Tasting Bar in Raleigh, brings his 10-year-old lab mix named Gruner to work several days a week. "We've always been dog-friendly," Dysing said. "It's a nice calming effect to have a dog laying around when people are shopping. We let customers bring their dogs in." He said that Gruner has his own fan club, and some customers will come to the shop in the store only when they know Gruner will be there. "People who enter the store usually like that a dog is there to greet them," Dysing said. Similarly, customers at Audubon Automotive know to look for Duke when they walk in. The 11-year-old black lab, who belongs to office manager Matthew Drake, has been coming to the office almost every day since Drake got him in 2008. "He likes people more than he likes other dogs," Drake said. "I know for us he's just a part of the team pretty much. He's also like an employee." Patrick Casey, manager for Green Front Interiors and Rugs, also employs his 5-year-old Maltipoo named Walter as a model. Walter frequently comes to the store to pose for photos used in the store's advertising. Casey said that he thinks smaller businesses are more likely to have dogs in the workplace because they have fewer rules and regulations to deal with. "If we were Pottery Barn, I certainly wouldn't be able to bring him in," he said. These benefits of having dogs in the workplace have been documented in recent studies. According to a 2016 report by Banfield Pet Hospital, a pet-friendly office contributes to a sense of well-being, reduced stress, greater work-life balance, and reduced guilt about leaving a pet at home. It can also lead to improved work relationships, increased productivity, and the ability to work longer hours. In addition, 83% of employees surveyed said they had a greater sense of loyalty to their employers when they were pet friendly and had policies in place, and 88% said having pets at work improves morale. Tracy Lorraine Farmer, owner of Crazy Comb Salon, who brings her English Golden Retriever Walter to work, said having him there attracts clients, especially those who don't have pets of their own. "I think there is something very therapeutic about petting dogs and receiving unconditional love from them," she said. Brown from the Animal Hospital at Briar Creek said pets can also benefit from the increased time with their owners. "Many feel happier when they're in contact with humans and have reduced separation anxiety." Brian Hare, founder of the Duke Canine Cognition Center and professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke, said that research suggests interacting with a dog can lower blood pressure as well as increase oxytocin, beta endorphins, and dopamine, which are associated with pleasure and loving feelings. Dogs are also affected by the relationship with us. They can also experience an increase in oxytocin, he said. This would have obvious benefits in the workplace. But what about potential problems with having dogs around? Some people are scared of dogs, and others may get distracted by the animals. Having a dog scare or bite a customer is certainly a concern, but this is typically easy to resolve, Dysing said. If a customer is a little skittish about a dog, we can bring it to the back room, he said. It's a very rare occurrence. We have more of a problem with unruly children than dogs. Most employers also make sure that their employees' pets are housebroken, well-behaved, and vaccinated before allowing them in the office. As for the best breeds to bring to the office, Brown said there is no ideal type. I've seen pit bulls that are the best dog in the entire world and chihuahuas that you wouldn't want anybody touching, she said. I think it just depends on the dog. And next from the News and Observer, white-collar job loss hurts most for many factory towns. With the abandoned smokestacks off the bay and ramshackle factories along 12th Street, it's easy to pin the blame for this industrial city's plight on the loss of manufacturing jobs to China and Mexico. Many, including President Donald Trump, hold the belief that shuttered factories are what primarily ails Erie and other aging blue-collar company towns. Yet, since 2008, Erie has suffered a less known and potentially more devastating exodus of well-paying white-collar jobs. Half its CEOs, 220 jobs, have disappeared. The city has shed 8% of its accountants, 10% of its computer workers, 40% of its engineers, and 20% of its lawyers, according to government data analyzed by the Associated Press. They are the professional class jobs that buttressed Erie's manufacturing might, and they are the type of work that has increasingly become the backbone of the U.S. economy. After reviewing Labor Department figures dating to 2008, the AP found that a third of major metro areas, nearly 80 communities, are shedding a greater percentage of white-collar than blue-collar jobs. In Ohio, such cities as Toledo and Canton have had a harder time retaining jobs in offices than on factory floors. It's a similar story in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and in Wichita and Topeka, Kansas, and Birmingham, Alabama, and Decatur, Illinois. That's one of the most painful aspects of the economic decline of these manufacturing centers. They get hit twice, said Enrico Moretti, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley. First, they lose the factories, but second, and most importantly, they lose everyone who was supportive of those factories. It's that second hit that increasingly matters nearly four decades since U.S. manufacturing employment peaked. Without a foundation of white-collar jobs, it becomes difficult for these areas to reinvent themselves in an era when the economy more and more requires specialized knowledge and technological skill. It's painful because it makes it even harder for the community to recover, Moretti said. Trump had rallied voters on the promise that he would restore factory jobs to revive areas that had lost them. But the data show how higher-paying occupations are abandoning smaller cities, taking with them a generation of workers who could otherwise start new companies or serve existing businesses. The AP reviewed data on employment by occupations from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics and compared metro area figures with national averages. Jobs that were categorized as white-collar include managerial, administrative, and sales positions. Blue-collar occupations include production, machine operation, and transportation positions. White-collar workers are increasingly shifting from smaller cities and settling in such thriving metro areas as Seattle, Nashville, and Chicago. As those higher-paying occupations become more highly concentrated, the wealth they generate is less likely to filter through the rest of the country. And while Trump and other political leaders vow to boost businesses with tax cuts, lower taxes may do little for communities with fewer white-collar workers who could plow them into new businesses. In Erie, many business leaders say the city mainly needs to keep and attract more white-collar workers. Its largest for-profit employer, Erie Insurance, recently restored an old armory and has been renovating old homes nearby, gradually turning part of the city into a corporate campus. Out of its headquarters, built as a replica of the Independence Hall, with hand-blocked French wallpaper depicting an American Revolution battle, the insurer is leading a private $40 million effort to fill the downtown with apartments and retail, in hopes that a friendlier streetscape will draw more employers and college graduates. For the company's CEO, the mission is personal. Tim Nicastro has five adult children. Only one has chosen to stay local. If this is successful 10 years from now, two more of my kids will move to Erie, he said. They will find a reason to get back here. It's the same high-stakes gamble many small and mid-sized cities face. Children who left for college aren't returning home as they once did. In larger cities, it's easier for white-collar workers to quit their jobs, to join employers that offer more money or opportunities for advancement. This trend has turned certain larger cities into magnets that draw employers and better-paid workers away from smaller cities. Size matters, and I think this dynamic is accelerating, said Mark Muro, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Census Bureau data show, for example, that Chicago added nearly 40,000 college graduates under age 35 since the Great Recession began in late 2007. Boston gained about 10,000, Denver 25,000. Community leaders in Erie note that manufacturing remains a strength for Northwest Pennsylvania, but it seems impossible to restore a long-gone era of prosperity that was built on factory work. Bob Glowacki, who heads a real estate management company, said the city must look beyond manufacturing. It's fine that Donald Trump says he's going to get all the companies that moved to China to come back to the United States, he said, but if that happened, you're only going to get back 20% of those jobs. Technology has replaced them, so how do you change that in Erie? And next, from the New York Times, China finds California wine pairs well with a trade war. Cabernet isn't the most obvious pawn in a trade war between the United States and China. Airplanes and their parts are the leading American export to China. Soybeans and wheat grow in Trump country. But China's selection of wine as a target of retaliatory tariffs did not surprise Michael Honig, a winemaker in the Napa Valley, where the tariff would hit hardest. The reason the government realizes they should penalize us is we are branded, said Mr. Honig, the president of Honig Vineyard and Winery. It's hard to go after a wheat grower because who is a wheat grower? It's a commodity. We are not a commodity. The news was an unwelcome turn of events for Mr. Honig and many California winemakers who have spent years trying to carve out a place in the hearts of wealthy Chinese consumers. That hard work has earned them a prized sliver of what is becoming one of the fastest-growing markets for wine imports. China's imports of American wine reached $82 million last year, not including bottles entering duty-free through Hong Kong, a sevenfold increase in the last decade. But growing visibility may have turned Napa wine into easy prey. Wine is something people can relate to, said Jim Boise, who has been covering the industry from Beijing for a decade on his blog, The Grape Wall of China. It's like putting a tariff on Chinese dumplings. It's something you can feel on an emotional and personal level. The 15% tariff announced Monday on top of existing tariffs and taxes is a gut punch to winemakers marketing their wares to the mushrooming legions of young, recently wealthy Chinese. It is that group one or two levels below China's ultra-rich that holds huge potential for California vintners. Those consumers are far more numerous than one percenters, and more crucially, they're the ones driving the recent blossoming of a wine culture in China in which bottles are actually consumed rather than simply traded among elites as trophies. Mr. Heinig and his business partner and wife, Stephanie, have spent a decade wooing that clientele, making a trip a year to China to pitch sommeliers in top restaurants and hotels. He has recently expanded beyond the obvious stops at Beijing and Shanghai, visiting cities like Guangzhou in southern China. There are people who want to spend the most, but they are also aspirational buyers, Mr. Honig said. You may want to buy the Rolls Royce, but you can afford the Mercedes, and that's his sweet spot. His most popular Cabernet goes for around $25 a bottle wholesale, and he sends more than 500 cases of it every year to a plucky Shanghai importing business started by two brothers with dual citizenship. With existing tariffs and value-added taxes mixed in, the total charge tacked onto California wine was already close to 50%. After the importer factors in shipping, takes its cut, and passes the bottles to hotels or a retail store, which takes its cut, the Napa Red ends up selling for the equivalent of around $100. An extra 15% charge would be brutal. No one wants to overpay, Mr. Honig said. If all they're looking at is two different bottles side by side, and we are competing with Australia and Chile, that's a big competitive disadvantage. Chilean and New Zealand wines face no Chinese levies, thanks to free trade agreements. Australian bottles will enter the country tariff-free next year. Larry Yang, an importer in Shanghai, said his customers like California wines, but not enough to ignore an even higher price tag. The wine isn't cheap as it is, he said, and if it gets pricier, he will look elsewhere. There are so many countries producing fine wine, he said. I don't have to buy a relatively expensive California wine. I could choose from New Zealand, Australia, Chile, and South Africa. And Chinese drinkers have a growing array of homegrown brands to choose from. Expert winemakers have spent years harvesting Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc varietals at the foothills of Heilan Mountains in Ningxia, a region that borders Inner Mongolia. And they have started winning international awards, even beating out French favorites. Then the government began protecting its domestic players. And I've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So long, until next time.